Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten, mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto, das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, Russia's president is heading to North Korea for his first talks there in almost a quarter of a century. We hear what two of the world's most sanctioned nations have to offer each other as economies. Also, Boeing's CEO is getting ready for a grilling in the US Senate over the recent rocky performance of one of the world's biggest aircraft makers. Another US electric vehicle startup files for bankruptcy. The art of making tourism sustainable, and how a new AI tool can help fruit growers improve their profits by predicting the harvest.
Because if you know how much you're going to harvest, then you can plan how many people you're going to hire for the work and the machinery that you're going to rent.
That's all coming up on the programme, but let's start with the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, who is on his way to North Korea on his first visit to Pyongyang for almost a quarter of a century. He's going to meet the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, and the idea is to deepen the relationship between two of the most heavily sanctioned nations in the world, who are also now big trading partners. A reporter in the South Korean capital, Seoul, is Shaima Khalil.
What we're looking at is this ongoing deepening relationship, that the optics of which they want to, both leaders want to sell this as a deepening bilateral, multi-sided relationship at its core, I think. These are two heavily sanctioned leaders and countries with weakening economies that each wants what the other has in terms of defense mechanisms. It is very worrying to the West. The real concern here for the U.S. and for South Korea, where I am, is the effect this is going to have on inter-Korean relations on the Korean Peninsula.
Shaima Khalil. So there is a strong economic basis for this partnership. North Korea's economy has been in very bad shape for decades. What it does have is technology and weapons, and Russia needs both for its Ukraine war. Dr. Peter Ward is a fellow at the Sejong Institute in Seoul and specialist on the NK economy. He said the link is valuable to both Moscow and Pyongyang.
I'd say that it's become very, very important in the last couple of years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We have many credible reports from the US, from Ukraine and from other countries that North Korea has been providing substantial amounts of military materiel and munitions to the Russian side and has been receiving payment in return in the form of technological assistance with its space program, maybe with some other weapons development, although that's not clear, and probably received some food from the Russian side, although yet again, we're not sure how much. And maybe also some hard currency, although, yet again, we don't know how much.
As you say, a lot of this is unknown, I guess, just by the nature of the regime there and how it works. But is there a sense of how bad the North Korean economy is? I mean, there have been lots of reports over the years of starvation, all kinds of things, and how much this is helping.
So we have some data points. So there are organizations that have contacts inside North Korea who are able to get information about the state of the North Korean economy, food prices, fuel prices, the value of the North Korean won on the North Korean market relative to the US dollar and RMB. So this data indicates that food prices are, at least in US dollar terms, relatively stable, especially when you consider the global price of food generally. The situation doesn't appear to be good, but it is not as bad as it has been in the past. most other reports we get from inside the country, the economy is not doing well. But yet again, things are not as bad as they were, especially during COVID, when they closed off the entire country to the outside world. And there were some very, very serious problems with the food supply, more in 2021 than now, though. Things are better by the looks of things.
And how does this play in with its relationship with China? Because in the past, it's obviously had a lot of support from China. Does this relationship with Moscow, in a way, give it another option?
So this is a source of quite a lot of debate and discussion. The Chinese like to signal to the outside world that they're not particularly happy with this burgeoning relationship. But at the same time, they also have increasingly cordial relations with Moscow as well. We had the recent meeting between Xi Jinping and Putin, where the two sides committed yet again to a no-holds-bar, unlimited friendship, as it were. So on the one hand, the Chinese try to present themselves as being rather skeptical or concerned about ties between Pyongyang and Moscow. But on the other hand, they also have rather good ties with Moscow themselves and continue to be North Korea's primary trading partner.
And I was going to say, on that trading issue, is there a sense in which North Korea is hugely dependent on, I guess, Moscow and Beijing in a way that means it's almost existential in terms of actually getting any kind of trade and therefore any kind of economy going?
Almost all of North Korea's external economic relations are with China, at least so far as we know from the data that is available. So most of North Korean imports come from China and most North Korean exports go to China. We don't obviously have data on the extent of North Korean weapons exports to Russia and how much they've been paid for these. But one would assume that they've been paid something quite substantial. And this will be helping their economy and helping to make them less dependent on China.
And I suppose on the most basic level, what is it that North Korea can offer? Tech, you said, in some ways, I guess, tech knowledge. What else?
So North Korea has been described as a modern hunter-gatherer economy. This is Marcus Noland, who's one of the foremost experts on North Korean economy worldwide, described it in such terms. And what that means is it sells things it can hunt or gather, such as fish, coal, and other commodities. It also is a producer, or was in the past, a major producer of textiles, primarily for the Chinese market. But since sanctions have been put in place, we don't really know the extent of North Korean exports to the outside world, because the Chinese Chinese export data may not be including the full extent of what they're selling to China. Aside from that, yes, of course, they also sell weapons and have sold weapons to other countries in the past, as well as now to Russia.
And there's no doubt that Ukraine has been a hugely good thing in that sense for North Korea, because it's given wider options for it to trade these kind of things.
Yeah, I think there is very little doubt about that, given the U.S. government and other governments have released in terms of intelligence with respect to North Korean weapons transports to the Russian side. I think there's very little doubt that they are benefiting quite considerably from the war in Ukraine.
And that was Dr. Peter Ward of the Sejong Institute in Seoul. Now, the U.S. aircraft maker Boeing's had a rough few years. 5 years ago, two 737 MAX aircraft were lost in separate but almost identical accidents, killing 346 people. More recently, an unused door fell off a brand-new 737 MAX plane during a flight operated by Alaska Airlines, leaving a gaping hole in its side. Meanwhile, Boeing whistleblowers have been telling the U.S. Senate back in April that several of its models have serious production issues. Well, now the outgoing chief executive, David Calhoun, is about to appear in front of a Senate subcommittee. His preliminary remarks have already been published, showing he's adopting an apologetic tone. But what can he expect from the lawmakers? Well, joining me now in the studio is our international business correspondent, Theo Liggett. Theo, is there a way in which this company has got a long way to go to rebuild its reputation?
I think it's got a huge way to go to rebuild its reputation. And part of that is because, as you mentioned, there were those two catastrophes 5 years ago when two brand new 737 MAXs were lost in identical accidents. Those accidents were attributed to badly designed software, the design of which Boeing had actually concealed partly from regulators. That was an intense period for the company. It put a huge focus on its attitude towards safety, raised huge questions about whether the company was putting a pursuit of profits over passenger safety, all that kind of thing. That was 5 years ago. Then we had this incident in January involving the same family of aircraft, the 737 MAX, and involving serious quality control problems in one of its factories. And the problem that Dave Calhoun is facing is that he's been in his job for 4 years now. He joined the company in January 2020. He's repeatedly said the company do things better. People within the company constantly say that safety is at the heart of everything they do. And yet here we are again, 5 years later, with a chief executive appearing before senators saying, yes, we got things wrong, sorry.
Is he going to get a rough ride, do you think?
I think he will get a rough ride. I mean, he is going in there in an apologetic mood. He will apologise to the victims of those accidents. He'll say that safety is at the heart of everything the company does. And he'll provide examples of what it is doing now. And there is a big plan, a safety and quality action plan, which has to be approved by regulators for Boeing to address its problems. So he'll go in on that note. But then he will be asked about his own contribution. We can be fairly sure of that. He'll be asked why there are still major problems with a supplier, Spirit AeroSystems. He'll be asked why there are still problems in the factories. And he's likely to be asked about the catalogue of allegations, really, made by a whole series of whistleblowers, some of whom quite recent ones. You know, one of them whose allegations have been published over the past 24 hours is a current Boeing employee. So that will be deeply embarrassing, I think. Let's not forget, Dave Calhoun is supposed to be leaving Boeing.
Yeah, he's out the door in fairly soon, isn't he?
He is, but all of this is creating a problem for Boeing. They need a competent chief executive to take over from him, someone who is capable of taking this process forward and reinvigorating confidence in the company. But at the moment, who would take that job on?
There's a question. Thanks, Theo. Theo Leggett there, our international business correspondent. Well, let's get a sense of how this has been playing on the markets. Joining me now is Fiona Sincotta, market analyst at City Index. Fiona, thanks for being with us. Well, first of all, I mean, Boeing's obviously going through a bit of a time, as we heard there from Theo. How's its share price doing?
Well, the share price has, unsurprisingly, I think, fallen quite sharply so far this year. It's down around 30%. And I think when we sort of do a comparison against, you know, performances in the broader market that's up around 15% the S&P at the moment, or even with Airbus, which is up 4%. So, I mean, that just really reflects the level of distrust in the company and the fact that shareholders have just wanted to sell out of the share. So, I mean, it does highlight, I think, the impact that these events have been having on the company and the value of the company as well.
And talking of morale problems, we've had interesting data from German investors today. The famous ZEW Economic Research Institute on their regular monthly look, and it doesn't look good, does it?
No, it's a bit disappointing, to be honest, which is a bit of a shame because, you know, data coming out of Germany had been starting to show sort of signs of improvement, but it actually was a little bit weaker than expected, rising to 47.5. That was below the 50 that it's expected. But I think the reason that we had that disappointing data was probably because we saw a slightly stronger inflation figure from Germany as well in the month of May. So that's probably just made or sown some nervousness within the economic sentiment.
OK, thanks very much for being with us, Fiona. Fiona Sincotta there, market analyst at City Index. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, the world of electric car making is potentially very profitable, but it's also very risky. Now, Fisker, a US startup that released its first electric vehicle model last year, has filed for bankruptcy protection. It's just the latest amongst a crop of once high-flying EV startups that hope to transform the traditional car industry, but have run out of cash. Lordstown Motors and bus manufacturer Arrival, are among the others who've also taken the bankruptcy route. So is the transition of the car industry from the internal combustion engine to battery power in a bit of trouble, or is this, well, just a bump in the road? Well, Scooter Doll is a reporter for Electrek, a news site that extensively covers electric vehicles, and joins me now. Scooter, thanks for being with us. I mean, just a sense, first of all, was this expected, what happened to Fisker?
Yeah, I believe so. Covering this segment of the industry, it's always sad to report when you see a startup fail like this. But there were plenty of signs leading up to the recent news of bankruptcy dating back to 2023. We saw the Ocean launch, which was a huge milestone, actually reaching production for a startup with the help of Magna Steyr in Austria. But as 2023 went on, we saw Fisker continuously changing its production output targets, lowering them, relaying that it was trying to remain liquid. So we could tell that it was struggling. So leading up to today's news, it's sad, but we've already seen filings that kind of hinted at this. So it's not shocking. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's good. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to draw from you, is there a sense that, as I was saying in my introduction, that perhaps there's something not quite working with the whole EV industry? You know, we assumed everyone would be moving in one direction, but you've got the challenge, obviously, from Chinese cars, you've got other challenges around the world. Is this industry in a bit of a mess?
I wouldn't say it's a mess. I'd say if you look at the overall global outlook, it's steady, long-term growth. EV adoption is already reached critical mass here, but in terms of the startup world, like I say in a lot of my coverage, scaling is hard and it's expensive. So you're seeing a lot of companies fail because they just don't have the liquidity, they don't have the cash flow to reach scale production. Tesla was almost went bankrupt trying to scale the Model 3. It worked out for them, but you see a lot of EV startups fail because it requires a lot of money.
And is that a sort of central problem for the industry that you wouldn't have seen in traditional automaking because of the different needs it has? I mean, is it something the whole industry can get past?
I think the whole industry could get past, but the disconnect here is that a lot of these startups have the technology, but not the money. And then you're seeing legacy automakers that have the manufacturing know-how, the infrastructure, the logistics in place, but they don't have the technology. So they're a little late to the party. They're trying to play catch up, and a lot of them are putting out quality EVs, but they're still behind.
Yeah, so it's good. I mean, is there another issue here as well, which is the one that comes up perennially with this, which is basically down for infrastructure? I mean, people are not going to buy EVs if they don't think they've got a place to charge them, fundamentally, or lots of places on a long journey. And that infrastructure still isn't there in the US, is it?
It's not, and it is... It's a progress. It's a process. It's taking longer than anticipated, and it will get there. It requires a lot of money. There's a lot of red tape, but the technology is improving. And I think the bigger hurdle, Roger, is education. I think a lot of consumers think they need more range than they do. I think they think they're going to be charging on fast chargers on highways more than they actually will, rather than charging at home. And I think that's an even bigger hurdle to overcome than the infrastructure itself.
Scooter, thanks for being with us. Scooter Dahl there of Electrek, reflecting on the fact that Fisker, an EV startup, has now filed for bankruptcy in the US. Now, when is tourism good tourism? When is it just too much? It's the summer holiday season for many of us. You might be planning your own getaway soon. But will your trip be welcome news to the people living there? Well, in yesterday's programme, you might remember, we heard how mass tourism is proving unpopular amongst locals in some holiday hotspots. In the Greek island of Rhodes, summer tourism is not only already in full swing, but set for another bumper season, despite last year's devastating fires. Now local officials and businesses are turning their attention to more sustainable tourism as they hope to become a beacon for eco-friendly holidays. Victoria Craig's been to Rhodes to find out more.
These sparkling turquoise Mediterranean waters lure 2.7 million vacationers to Rhodes each year. Tourism makes up 97% of this economy, which means attracting people year after year isn't a luxury, it's a necessity.
Even though that we had to evacuate parts of the island in July, August was the best August ever.
That's Christos Mikulaikis, Rhodes Deputy Culture Minister.
We discussed for another record year. We're sure that it's going to be approximately 5% more than last year.
That's welcome news for hoteliers like Anda Kariani, who runs the Irene Palace Beach Resort, which sits about 18 miles away from where firefighters battled blazes last year. She said the disaster has ignited a conversation for the industry about how it can and should adapt to the effects of climate change.
We are part of the nature, of the environment, part of the society. So what we do applies to the environment, the society. It has to be the culture of each one, single person, and then of the whole island.
Greece is one of the top European destinations for cruise ships, with one study showing it's also among the countries most affected by the hulking vessels' vast emissions. The government is working toward a program that'll require cruise ships in the harbor to only operate on solar energy gathered on the island. It's also executing a program called the Rhodes CoLab, established in 2022 with the TUI Care Foundation, an independent charity founded by the German tourism company of the same name. One of the CoLab's goals is eliminating single-use plastics by 2027.
It's about making it easy, normalizing it for those who want to do, but even for those who don't really care. Because if you make it easy for even those that don't even think about it, people will automatically and by default act in a more sustainable way.
That's Marina Novelli, a professor of marketing and tourism at the UK's Nottingham University Business School.
You know, I've just returned from Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe, where at my check-in in the hotel, I was given a refillable bottle. You know, if it can happen in a remote destination like Zimbabwe in the African continent, I don't see why this could not happen in European destination like Rhodes, for instance.
Back at Andakariani's Irene Palace Beach Resort, she tells me all of these initiatives not only move the needle on sustainability efforts, but hopefully make for a deeper connection between a tourist and their destination.
Victoria Craig reporting. Now, in the Kenyan capital Nairobi over the last few hours have been chaotic scenes as police used tear gas and water cannon to try and break up protests. People were demonstrating against plans to increase some taxes and introduce new ones. Parliament's debating the new bill at the moment. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross reports.
This feels like a significant moment as many young Kenyans are telling the government they'll not accept yet more taxes. They've risked the police tear gas and some were taken away in handcuffs as they marched against the new finance bill. President William Ruto has backed down to a degree. Parts of the bill are to be dropped, including plans for a bread tax. Kenya's national debt is nearly $80 billion. That's why Mr. Ruto wants to increase taxes. But people are pushing back against the political elite, which is widely viewed as corrupt. And they're questioning the wisdom of, for example, a new tax on sanitary pads.
Will Ross. Well, these young protesters said the taxes were so high they were unable to build a life for themselves.
I am still a young adult and I want to build myself up in this country. And with such taxes, with such exploitation, I don't see how we can build a life here. I want to get kids here. I want to get married here. I want to build a life here. I want to own property here. And this is making it very hard for us, especially us that are not a part of the 1%. I am very angry and I'm fighting for my future. I'm fighting for my fellow's futures and I'm fighting for my country.
Everyone protesting today, it will shift something. If it doesn't completely change, it will create a shift. And that's what protests do. It's not always that we're looking for the end game, but we're looking for a complete change. Protests shift attitudes and shift some of these policies that we're fighting against.
We are letting the parliament know, the government know what they're doing with this bill is wrong and it's not benefiting us as the common mwananchi. It's only going to benefit them. That's why I feel like it will make an impact.
Young protesters there in Nairobi. Now, for fruit producers around the world, one of the biggest problems each year is knowing how much your fields and orchards will actually produce, and knowing that in good time in order to plan irrigation, hiring pickers, and making sure it all gets to market. Well, now there's a new artificial intelligence tool that can help with all that. It's been developed by researchers at the UK's National Robotarium in Edinburgh. The idea is to predict the crop based on the flowers on the trees, and it can be done, apparently, using a smartphone. I spoke to Dr. Fernando Howard-Chain, one of the lead researchers on the AI tool, an associate professor in robotics and autonomous systems at the National Robotarium.
If you check the recent technology published on the field, most of the work are concerned on detecting the fruit, right? Detecting, classifying the fruit, and counting the fruit to have an estimation of how much the farmer is going to harvest. So I propose a different approach. Instead of counting the fruit, which actually doesn't add that much value to the process because you count the fruit when it's about to be harvested. So the farmer doesn't have enough time to make any decision. So what I propose is actually to count the flowers. There is a correlation between the flower density, the number of flowers that you have in the branch, with the number of fruits that you expect to harvest. So what I do actually is to count the flowers to then give an approximation of how much you are going to harvest according to that flower counting. So that is my approach. So you can have the information beforehand, like 6 months before harvesting. That gives you, as a farmer, plenty of time to do all the, you know, all the logistics and to refine your operational costs associated with the process.
So, Fernando, how does it work exactly then? So, you take a photograph? Is that how it does?
No. We created a new architecture based on machine learning and artificial intelligence techniques. You actually do not take a picture. What you do is, right now, you grab your phone and you just with the camera, you make a recording, a video of the environment. It's not picture by picture, it's just a video. So we process the entire video, not an image. So that is the main difference. So you can plug the camera either on your phone or a tractor or whatever and take it to the field. And as you are making the video, we are counting the flowers.
So you get the video, you look at the flowers that are there, and I mean, how do you count the flowers? I suppose that's an obvious thing because there must be an awful lot of them.
Yes, there is a lot of coding programming behind that. Each tree, each crop has different features. So in our case, since we are working especially with peach crops, those kind of trees, they have a high density flowering per each branch. It's not like when you're working with apple trees or you're working with avocado trees, which we actually are doing the same. In the case of the peach grove, you have in one branch hundreds of flowers. So to that specific purpose, we developed some special techniques for classifying and detecting all the flowers in one branch and not the flowers that you have in the rows behind the tree. We use advanced artificial intelligence architectures to do that. But our aim is to be able to deliver this outcome in, you know, any system that can be managed by anyone. That's why we are using our cell phones, actually, just as, you know, as an interface to get all the videos that we need.
Okay, so have you tried this out yet? I mean, do you know it works?
Oh, because we validated in the growth. So our system is not only trained, it's also validated and tested. And now we are doing the same for avocados, for apples, and for lemons.
Where did you test it? What area and what sort of crop did you look at?
Okay, so the peach grove was in Spain, in Catalonia. The apple grove is in California. And the avocado grove is in Chile, actually.
So how far ahead can you predict what the fruit crop will be? Is it a long way before?
All depends on the crop, actually. From the flowering to the fruit, depending on the crop, you are going to have a time interval. For our case, we can predict up to 6 months. And the accuracy in the flower counting is around 90%. What we need now to unveil is that exact correlation between the number of fruit to be harvested and the number of flowers that we detected. So that is the work that we are planning for this summer.
And I suppose if you can make these kind of predictions, the farmers can use their resources. I mean, they won't waste water, for example.
Absolutely. And also to improve, actually to minimize the cost associated with the logistics. Because if you know how much you're going to harvest, then you can plan how many people you're going to hire for the work and the machinery that you're going to rent according to the number to the expected outcome.
And that was Dr. Fernando Hawat-Chain, who's one of the lead researchers on that AI tool, also associate professor in robotics and autonomous systems at the National Robotarium. Who knew that the National Robotarium existed? Sounds a bit sinister, but it isn't. It comes up with AI tools that clearly are able to actually bring about, well, some profitability for farmers. Because the AI gets quite a bad rap in many, many ways. People fearful about it, but I suppose that's one example where it can do good. As I hope did we hear on World Business Report.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.